to The Deep Dive. I'm Larry Kamer. The Deep Dive is an in-depth discussion of some of the most important issues facing us here in the Napa Valley and in wine country. On our program, we try to present conversations and issues and stories in a way that you might not hear them anywhere else. We originate from the studios at KVON in beautiful Napa, California. Our new shows air every Thursday at 9 o'clock, and you can always listen to our past shows on our website at kvon.com. And I'm happy to say we have quite a few older shows since we started this program in January. We are always happy to hear from you and are especially welcoming of your suggestions about future discussions, issues to talk about, and possible guests. You can email us at deepdiveshow@winedownmedia.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram at deepdiveshow. And you can like us on our Facebook page, which is also called Deep Dive Show. I especially enjoyed our conversation last week with Rob McMillan of Silicon Valley Bank. Rob is the author of the State of the Wine Industry 2020 report, which is a pretty influential document in the wine industry. I have to say I learned a lot about the wine-consuming habits of millennials and boomers, and Rob's concerns that the industry is perhaps being awfully slow to respond to its current marketing challenges. So head on over to kvon.com, listen to that, and all of our previous interviews. We have two segments today. In the second part of the show, we're going to look at the fraught future of recycling. The economics underlying much of the U.S. recycling system are eroding and have begun to fall apart in some U.S. communities. China, which is the largest buyer of recycled materials, has cut way back on what it will buy. And changing consumer behavior has made the trash sorting part of the business ever more complex. So we'll learn more about how this challenge is playing out with Tim Dewey Mattia. He's with Napa Waste and Recycling Services. But first, we want to take a few minutes to remember the shooting at the Pathway Home in Yountville, whose second anniversary is coming up next week. Now, so much has been written and broadcast about this tragedy, so my purpose today is not to relive or rehash or do a TikTok of events on March 9th, 2018, but to do something that I think is more important, and that is to remember those whose lives that day were lost or otherwise affected. There are hundreds and hundreds of people who were involved and who still live with the aftermath of that incident. It's important to say people's names on the anniversary of their death, so we remember the three brave women, Jennifer Golick, Christine Lober, and Jennifer Gonzalez. The shooter, whose name I will not mention, also died, and in law enforcement parlance, four deaths makes it a mass shooting. Professional vets and professional staff and the vets who lived on premise were also potential target of that gunman. They were released, but they are not unaffected. So as I look back on the events of that day, I remember the first responders, the subsequent responders, which numbered into the hundreds. I was on site. It is difficult to describe the scene with massive police and SWAT team presence, dozens of people involved in running the operation, helicopters, the works. Lots has been written and said about the Pathway Home, and several of the people who were able to survive that day have shared their accounts and the aftermath of the past couple of years. But one person we have not heard from is Devereaux Smith. Devereaux Smith was working as the Pathway Homes development and marketing director, and was there on that day. Many of you know that Devereaux is also my wife, and there are very few days that have gone by in the past couple of years that we have not talked about the events of that day. So, Dave, welcome.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be here. I want to start by saying, Larry, I'm really proud of you for this show. You have done such a great job. I am really happy to talk about my experiences on the two-year anniversary. I'm interested in taking this experience and putting it in a place where I'm reframing my life. I feel like for the past 2 years, the events of the day have been in front of me, and I now want to move to a place where the events of the day are behind me. Sorry, I'm getting a little direction here.
It's the sophisticated radio business.
When I talk about the events of the day being behind me, I in no mean want to, or I in no way want to diminish the tragedy of the families and the people who lost their lives. So I really am committed to being a better leader in the Napa Valley, and I feel like getting to a point where I can talk about this openly is just going to be a really helpful thing. I want to start by talking about the three brave women that I worked with, and just sharing my own experience and memory of them. Christine, well, let me say, when I first went to Pathway Home, Larry and I had moved up to the Napa Valley, and I was running a public health clinic in Oakland. And so for a few years, I was commuting and not feeling connected to Yountville, my favorite hometown. And when the opportunity came up for me to meet with Christine Lober, I thought, you know, what do I have to lose? Let's have a conversation.
And Christine was the executive director.
The executive director and one of the three brave women. When I met with Christine, she was so engaging and infectious that I just said, I want to work with this woman. I was moving into doing fundraising in the field of working with veterans, which isn't something I had done before. I've always been worked in women's health. So I went to work with Christine and this crew of amazing women. Christine was just infectious. She was passionate about her work. She had an immense vision for Pathway Home. She was serious and funny and brilliant and creative and caring.
And she lit up a room. I mean, she really had that incredible presence about her.
She really did. And, you know, she just was full of new ways to engage all of us and connect us all the time. The morning of the shooting, I look back on this memory and it makes me have a smile because right before that morning, Christine gave me a lesson in doing Irish step dancing while walking down the hall. And she was just so happy that she couldn't stop herself from just being so exuberant. Jen Golick and Jen Gonzalez-Shushariba were great, dedicated, professional, caring women. Jen Golick loved the Giants, and she loved bragging about her daughter's basketball games. Jen Gonzalez-Shushariba was someone who just radiated beauty and happiness. She took long walks every day so that she'd stay in good shape for the baby. She was about 6 months pregnant when she was killed. And she just loved, you know, sharing her excitement about having a daughter with us. I have other memories of Pathway Home that I want to just share a little bit as well.
Sure.
And I'm talking about the program. The program had the great love and support of someone most of you know, Dorothy Salmon. And through her vision and the vision of the board, they really created Pathway Home that I call Point Two.
The program was
really moving forward and creating great relationships in the community. After the events of March 9th, after Pathway closed, the leadership of the board and Dorothy Salmon went on to create a guide for Rotary clubs around the country to use in working with veterans. I don't know if you know this, but the Rotary clubs in Napa had been super supportive of Pathway Home,
right,
so there was
right.
a big connection.
They were their kind of roots into the community. Right.
And it was great for the community, too, because it gave people an outlet to do something supportive to at Pathway Home, these guys who had, you know, had seen so much and were suffering so much.
Well, and lots of people, you know, ask what can, lots of people are concerned about vets, and they're especially those who are struggling with mental health issues. And the question is always, what can they do to help? And I think that network through Rotary helped people find a way to do very specific things to help, in addition to raising money and publicizing what they were doing.
Right. They were such a good partner. So this is a way to create a legacy for the Pathway Home. Some other things to mention, there were some very talented clinicians who, there were two younger clinicians who were part of the four women who were let go. And there was a woman who was very, who is very brilliant in policy analysis. And she's gone on to find her own voice talking about this. And I feel very lucky to know all three of them. Larry had asked me to talk about what are lasting effects for me.
Right.
And they're a lot of them are physical. It's still really hard for me to be in a crowd. Larry's sister and I are super close. I'm sure she's listening, my tante. And she has a dog toy business called Happy Hands Happy Dogs, by the way. And she
which you
does
can purchase on the internet.
Yes. Which and she does a trade show in Las Vegas every year, and I am her booth assistant.
And we should mention that my sister lives in Boston, so she is probably our furthest flung fan of the Deep Dive.
Yes, and she was also one of the first people to come hold my hand after the event and hold the hands of our family. Anyway, I go to Vegas with her every year, and these past 2 years have been really stressful being in those big crowds.
Because that trade show has like tens of thousands of people.
It does, and they hold it in the hotel where the horrible, horrible shooting in Las Vegas took place.
Right, Mandalay.
And when I talked to my trauma therapist about this at the time, he said, "Are you crazy? Why would you go to that site?" So being in crowds is really, really tough. The last 2 years, and it's gotten much better in the last couple of months, it was pretty impossible not to just start crying spontaneously.
Yep.
And the bigger piece that really affects Larry's life is that I have had a lot of trouble sleeping. And so all of those symptoms are getting better, but those are definitely lasting effects.
And we talk about PTSD, and you know, like so many other things, we think we know what it really is. And some of the effects of PTSD are very profound and serious, and some of them are every day. And some of them are, you know, as you're describing, somewhere in the middle.
Right. And one of the things I think that's hard for people in a position that I'm in is that there is a protocol designed by someone in the universe that says you will have six sessions of trauma therapy and then you will be fine.
That's what they'll pay for.
And so that is their prescription.
Right.
And so I've certainly gone on to have additional therapy. But to suggest that just because you do that, you're finished is just sort of a silly thing.
So it's definitely better, but not over.
Oh, yeah, I would agree with that. But it's also not acute. That's the important thing to remember as well. It's gotten much better.
All right. So what was it that helped you work through this experience over the last couple of years?
Well, there's lots of things. There's organizations and community and people, so I want to talk about them separately.
Sure.
I hope that my Rotary friends who are listening will smile when I say that a place that became a very safe spot of comfort is Napa Sunrise Rotary. And I say that despite my bad attendance lately, but it became a really caring place for me to go and just be and not worry.
We should point out that Napa Sunrise Rotary meets at 7 o'clock on Thursday mornings.
Which explains my bad attendance of late. And also, I don't know how many of you are familiar with a group or a process called Leadership Napa Valley. And right after the events of March 9th, Larry was very encouraging / really encouraging to...
We have such a subtle way about me.
Yeah, it wasn't subtle. To have me apply. And fortunately, I was chosen. Leadership Napa Valley is a 9-month cohort program where you learn all the different lanes of what happens in our community up and down the valley. And this group of 30 people who I would not otherwise ever come in contact with became a buffer for me. And it turns out that there were people in the class who also had a lot of connections to the events of March 9th. And so I think those two places where I could go and just feel supported and safe were invaluable.
You know,
I also really want to do a giant shout out to Allison Haley and her staff, including Yuko, and I don't remember Yuko's last name.
She's the only Yuko who works
I'm
there.
I'm sure she's the only Yuko, and she's terrific. Allison Haley played a really important part in helping myself. I can't speak for the other three women that I was with, but myself sort of work through a little bit the events of the day. It was one of the things that is challenging, I think, and I might talk about this later, for people who didn't lose their lives, and again, the most serious thing that could ever happen, but who were part of the situation. One of the challenging things is you don't have a way to get information. And in this...
You're talking about in the aftermath.
In the aftermath. And get information about, you know, what was behind the event, what were the steps of the shooter,
right.
What happened after we left the building. I mean, I had no way of knowing any of that. And I think you have to know that to start healing a little bit.
Right.
The CHP would not release any information to us, and we asked in a number of different ways, and they were adamant. And I regret that, and am sorry to criticize, but they could have done a much better job.
Well, I'm told by a little bird that there were several frank and honest exchanges of views between the DA's office and the CHP over this very issue.
Well, and because of that, and because our DA, Allison Haley, and her staff and her investigator were so caring, they held a private session with us to go through the investigation reports so that we could have some closure on the events of the day. They didn't have to do that. They didn't have to follow up. They didn't have to reach out and make sure we were okay. And for myself, can never thank them enough for that.
I might point out for those who are listening who may have missed it, 2 weeks ago, Allison Haley was our guest here on the Deep Dive. We didn't really talk much about the events of March 9th, 2018, but I would encourage you to take a look, go to kvon.com, take a look at and pull up that interview and listen to it, because I agree with Devereaux. She's quite extraordinary, and she was really one of the heroes of that day.
So other ways that this event affected our life, and this is probably the only point where I might get a tiny bit teary, is it's heartbreaking for me to think how much this hurt our family. And I'm going to let Larry talk a little bit about that
so that I don't get
too teary.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is something else that we haven't really discussed very much. What's interesting is our kids both work in the mental health field, and so they see a lot of these issues and have studied a lot of these issues, you know, kind of academically and objectively, but it's very different when it comes home to your family, and
It really just shook the foundation, and we had to hold each other close for a long time.
Right.
And of course still do, but... I said to some friends recently, it's taken me 2 years to get out of my own way on this topic and actually really look around and think who else has been affected by this in ways that I can't imagine. And just this past week, I called our son to say, how did you even find out about the shooting? It had never even occurred to me to ask him about that. So that the effect on all of that was heartbreaking. On our kids.
I think you found out about
Larry.
It on the radio, wasn't it?
Or it was Nixle.
Through Nixle, right.
Which is sort of a cute thing that your children who live an hour and a half away have Nixle for your hometown to make sure you're okay.
I think I may have gotten a Nixle alert, or I heard it on the radio. I was on 29 driving south to meet a friend of mine for lunch, and I'm like, oh my God, and I did a U-turn. I didn't quite drive across the grassy strip, But I did a U-turn, probably illegally, and roared back up to Yountville, and it was that was the beginning of the chaos. It was organized chaos, but it was chaos.
So, and part of that that outreach and ripple too was hearing from our friends from around the country how they discovered this as well. And absent information, you know, it scared a lot of people, and I'm very sorry about that. Other ripples that I've come to learn now that I've gotten out of my own way are the effect of this event in our own little community of Yountville. I had a really heartbreaking conversation with a mom whose daughter went to the elementary school. And she was very clear with me, the mom was very clear with me about how much it's affected her daughter.
This is the Yountville Elementary School.
The Yountville
school.
Public School, right. Yeah. The other thing that I can't stress enough is how great all of our friends in Yountville were about this situation. There were a couple of months where we couldn't go anywhere without someone giving us food. And
which at least one of us doesn't really need that much of.
I still chuckle that when I was in lockdown, I was getting texts from different bartenders around Yountville.
Because they missed you.
So I think that, you know, the lesson is we can't underestimate how things like this are affecting people beyond our immediate view. So I'm going to leave it at that. The people that kept me sane.
Right. Yeah. Talk about that.
Were certainly my children and my dear husband. In our family, we have a nickname for all of us. We call all of us Tonties. And so all of my Tonties out there were terrific.
It's too long a story to explain here. Maybe yeah. We'll get to it on a future program.
And then I have a BFF of 40 years, and both my Tontie and my BFF were here within weeks of each other just to, you know, help me get through the day and have been great support. And then random, there's a woman out there named Janet Brown who I adore. And I haven't seen her for quite a while, but she was in leadership with me and had this innate ability to tell, oh, Devereaux's going over the edge here. And she would come and direct me out of the room or just make sure I was okay. So I hope she's listening and
your wing people.
She was definitely a wing person. My advice for other people.
Right.
Is to, when you're in this situation, is to take, and I learned this from Allison, Haley, and Yuko, these words, take gentle care. Don't have expectations of yourself. Just put one foot in front of the other and get through the day. And hopefully at some point you'll start to see a little clearing of the clouds.
So a lot of people, and we had a few of them on several weeks ago, people who have been touched by gun violence in their family, all survivors, who talked about how important it was to have an outlet, some kind of activism, a cause. Have you found that to be useful or encouraging?
I am a huge admirer of one of my colleagues who has gone on to really embrace herself in the Every Town Survivor Network. She's well known locally around here, and I think she's an amazing talent and committed person. My sister has become a mom's demand giant in Ohio where she lives, Gemma. And I admire, of course, that's wonderful what they're doing. I have not found my place yet. And having this conversation today is a way of starting that. My own personal interest is in working to identify ways that people who aren't the victims, but who are still deeply affected, and that is people like me who were in the room, it's people who were law enforcement, who were deeply inside the event, who were hugely affected and have their own trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to make those situations better yet, but that's something that I want to explore. Politically, I am of the Beto O'Rourke school of get rid of assault weapons. I don't personally
think there's
any... In the communities
or off the battlefield.
Yes, yeah. Off the battlefield.
Yeah.
I don't have any other bold statements beyond that. But I think that we as a community need to pay more attention to people who are surviving these incidents.
I really want to thank you for opening up and coming on. I know this we've talked about this a lot, and it was not easy, but I think it's important from time to time to talk about this kind of stuff. It's most important to remember those who lost their lives. That would be next Monday is the anniversary, March 9th. And Devereaux, thank you for coming on the Deep Dive.
I'm super happy to be here. I'm a little surprised it took me this many episodes to get on your show.
Yeah, well, next time, try slipping the host a little cash, I think.
Everyone, remember our three brave friends on Monday. They deserve all of our love.
Let's take a short break. I'm Larry Kamer. This is The Deep Dive. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Larry Kamer. Before we get to our next topic, where we're going to be talking about recycling and the realities of the recycling market, if you're a listener to the show, you know that I can't help myself and always want to offer just a couple of thoughts off the top. So we are in the aftermath of Super Tuesday. The election the whole election process was kind of turned on its head on the Democratic side. And we've been talking about the importance of voting, something that I think we can never, ever take for granted, for about 1,000 reasons. And we talked about this on the program last week. Napa went to the polls on Tuesday, just a couple of days ago, and the numbers were telling. We have about 80,000 registered voters in the county, and of those, approximately 23,000, about 28% of the eligible total, took the time to vote. How does that compare to other parts in neighboring counties? Well, in San Francisco, that number is about 36%. Same in Solano County. Contra Costa and Marin are at about 27, 28%, more similar to Napa. Oddly enough, when I went to look for the Sonoma County numbers, I couldn't find any numbers on the Registrar of Voters site. Now, that's taking a look at the top of the ticket, you know, people who are going to vote for who are going to vote in the presidential contest. So my question is this: in spite of a very spirited Democratic presidential primary, two contested supervisor elections here in Napa, a couple of very important referenda, both of which look like they're going to go down, only 28% of the eligible voters turned out in Napa. I'd be curious on your thoughts of why this is. So, you know, you can drop us a note or send us a tweet or hit us up on Instagram. But do you think this is going to get any better in November when we will have a red-hot presidential election and lots of other stuff on the ballot? So please get in touch with us and let us know. Now I want to bring on Tim Dewey Mattia, who heads public education for Napa Waste and Recycling. Tim, welcome so much to the Deep Dive.
Great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
I'll ask you the question I ask a lot of my guests. I imagine you did not just fall to earth as a waste and recycling expert. So tell us a little bit about how you got here.
Yeah, right. And you don't usually study recycling in college either. So, I actually am from the East Coast. Went to College of Vermont, little small college, Middlebury College.
Yes.
And I needed a job, you know, on campus, make a few bucks. Didn't want to work in the library and sit at a desk. And so I saw the flyer, you know, this was before we did everything online in the 90s, and went to a meeting for the college recycling program. And we had a little tiny recycling facility on campus where it was all hand sorted by students, and we ran a little baler, and we went to the dorms and collected cans and bottles and cardboard and newspaper. And that was my job on campus for 4 years. And it became my career. I moved to San Francisco right after I graduated, worked for a couple nonprofits in San Francisco on environmental and recycling issues, and then I've been working in Napa Recycling for almost 15 years.
Wow.
So I got into it kind of with the interest in the environment, but also an interest in like doing something practical. And I think that's the cool thing about recycling is it's environmental, but it's not abstract. It's like something you do every day.
Well, and there's a business element to it.
Yeah, and it's always changing.
Right.
And so, yeah.
So tell me about your job. You are the public education expert. What does that entail?
Yeah, so we're doing a lot of marketing and outreach around recycling and composting in our programs, right? So we're the, take it back one step, is we're the, right, the garbage and recycling company in Napa. And we also operate the Napa Recycling and Composting Facility. And so we have a contract with the city and the county, and we have to educate our customers, our residents, and our businesses and schools on the proper ways and why to recycle and compost. So yeah, it's all from having meetings and doing presentations and tours and developing all the pamphlets, and also now mostly our website and a lot of online digital advertising, and then also a lot of compliance reporting to the state. There's a lot of different regulations, a lot of research, a lot
I'm
of program planning.
Shocked that would be true in the state of California.
Yeah, and a lot of it is what drives our industry, but it's complicated.
So let's get into some of the bigger issues around recycling. You know, I read this week that there are some 60 cities around the United States that have outright canceled their recycling programs. Some have done partial cancellations, like they've stopped collecting glass. In Hawaii, I understand they no longer collect paper or plastic. And here's a quote that I found from a recycling expert who's a professor at Yale. She says, "The market for recycling has had a lot of shock. Cities are thinking, is this really worth it?" So my question to you is, are cities really rethinking recycling?
Yeah, there's been a little bit of hysteria about recycling in the last year. And a lot of this has come from outside of California. We haven't seen any California cities or counties quit recycling. We have really strong regulations. We also have a good setup of infrastructure here already to do recycling. But there has been a shock in markets, and this is because China stopped buying recyclables. And we've seen a huge dip in what we get paid for our recyclables. But I think this kind of brings up a larger point where, I mean, recycling is a business, but it's not just a business. It's a public service, right? We have to collect your garbage and your recyclables and your compostables for it's just like your water treatment.
Or your electricity.
And your electricity. Right. And I think sometimes people don't think of recycling that way. And so we do make some money off of recyclables, but it's still a service that's going to have to be provided. And you do save some money on putting in the landfill. And there's also a lot of environmental benefits and other benefits associated with it. So we're going to keep doing it. But there has been a shock, and it's kind of messed up the economics of the whole system, because all of our system is not just selling recyclables. It's collecting. It's building facilities. It's composting. It's trucking garbage to landfills. It's all kinds of things.
And these are very labor-intensive, human-intensive. I understand that there's more and more technology, robots, maybe even AI that's helping make the sorting process easier, but you're always going to have a people-based business, right?
We think so, and that's one of the cool things about recycling and composting is that actually provides jobs for people. It's a lot more jobs to sort recyclables and make compost than to just dump stuff in a landfill. It's about 10 times as many jobs. But there's still technological advances, and you see our trucks getting cameras and having tied in with iPads and all hooked in to get real-time requests from our customer service. And then on the sorting end of recyclables, right, there's AI sorting. We have a robot. We're going to add a second robot, and it assists in sorting. We still have 25 people doing the sorting of your recycling, but it's
physically standing
on a
line.
Conveyor belt.
Right.
Yeah, and some people don't realize that. They think we have the magic, gizmo machine that just sorts it all automatically, but it's still mostly hand sorted with augmented with machinery and now some robots. So it fits in and it helps. And now we have a new state-of-the-art composting operation where the air is blown through the piles via some blowers, and I can actually go on an app and turn the piles on and off.
You can.
That's cool. But I don't, because that's not my job.
Oh, I see.
but I could.
But if you were wanting to prank somebody.
Well, we had a tour yesterday, and I actually will tell folks, please come on a tour of our facility. It's very eye-opening. And
remind us where it is.
We're down in Levitton Way, which is right off of Highway 29, south of the airport, just on the border of American Canyon. We do public tours. Our next one's coming up on March 21st, and then we'll do one on Earth Day, April 22nd. So you can go on our website, our Facebook page, the city of Napa also posts it. But in our composting area, I can go press a button and it turns the blowers on. And so we were standing out there and I could like literally blow the air through these pipes.
Oh my gosh.
It was like a nice air conditioning I was out there.
To the squeals of delight of your tourist, right?
That's right.
So I was struck by this story of one city, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C. There, a major recycling center, which used to turn a profit, had to close. The operator is now paying truckers to haul that recyclable material away, and they are also seeking to raise rates, as often happens with local waste haulers. But they're finding themselves having to explain why customers are still paying for curbside pickup, right? It doesn't seem to add up. So what do you think is happening there, and is there any danger that we would get in a situation like that here?
I don't think it's a very big danger. There's always a danger that literally you could have nowhere to send your recyclables to make something else. I don't think that's where we're headed. So California has very strict recycling laws, and I think we would hope that at that point there would be some market prodding to... We still think there needs to be way more market support for recycling within the state of California. I think that's something that's come out of China closing off, is we need more California manufacturing of recycled products, and it's actually happening.
Well, how do you make that happen? You're not talking about government forcing them to
do it. No, it's incentives.
How do you... So what kind of incentives?
I mean, you charge people... The way we think is easiest is you charge for landfilling. You put a fee. There is a fee. It's $1.40 a ton. It hasn't changed in like 30 years. It's not even for inflation. Just assess that and give that money to help fund for recycling manufacturing, for composting, for infrastructure. It's infrastructure investment is really what it is. I mean, that's the thing that costs the most around here. And that would help. And so I think We're okay. And one of the things about that's different about a place, maybe, I don't know, that specific city outside of Washington, is that all of our systems are fairly integrated here, right? So we have a contract with the city of Napa. It's exclusive. Sometimes people say, hey, that's a monopoly. But what it does is it actually provides for a way to, there's a lot of costs associated with the trucks, right? Each one's like $400,000, facility upgrades. All your containers, it's $60 for one of those blue or brown or gray carts, and the labor and all these things. And so you can combine all that, right? We charge a rate, which I still think is a good deal compared to your cell phone or your cable bill, right? We come to your house every week three times. And it's whatever, $40 a month, $50 a month, depending on your size, way better than those. And it helps to kind of push the costs out and sort of spread the costs out. So about 20% of our revenue was historically from selling recyclables, and that's down now. But 80% is from charging rates. And so that helps for it. And that rate is
real. For garbage, basically.
Yeah, your garbage bill pays for disposing of garbage, but it also pays for recycling infrastructure, composting infrastructure, all these things, which we think are essential public services. And so that helps to pay. So if the... Right, so you've seen there's been some rate increases in the last year, and that's really because of infrastructure we've had to spend, or the city has had to spend, over 10, it's actually $20 million almost for infrastructure, and then also because of recycling markets. And so when you see a 5 or 10, you see a couple bucks go up on your bill, that's what it is all paying for.
And you've got labor costs, you've got gas and fuel, you've got all the things that... you may be in some ways a utility with a monopoly, but on the other hand, you are a business that has to do business in the marketplace, in the real world.
Yeah, I mean, it is sort of, I know it's cliche, but it is a it's a public-private partnership in a lot of ways, and it's a little bit of a hybrid. And this is just how the kind of trash business has evolved. It's a utility, but it's not just city-run for most places in California. It's mostly through private contracting, except for a very few. There's a few other ones that are doing public.
Do you think that companies like yours should be obligated only to collect those things where there's a market for them, those recyclables, and not make the pretense of collecting other things if they're ultimately going to go into the garbage, just have people throw those into the trash?
Yeah, it's a good question. First of all, we're kind of obligated to collect everything that's not hazardous, right? And we currently have three bins. At some point it could be different, but right now, and we've been doing it for a while, there's three bins.
So people we're going to become accustomed to
that. Yeah, and we're going to try to work within that. Like, we added food scraps to yard trimmings, right? And so that's all for compost now. For recycling, yeah, I think one of the things that happened in the last 10 years is I think a lot of programs started to accept more plastics in the recycling with the hope that they could recycle them. And what we've really tried to strip back now is to be really transparent about what we actually can recycle and tell our customers the truth, right? And it's a lot of detail, unfortunately. There's a lot of nuance. You can't just say we recycle plastic. We recycle some types of plastic, and here's the examples of what we can recycle, and here's the examples of the things that you should put in the garbage, and then here's some alternatives if you don't want to throw your plastic in the garbage. And we've really been developing that information on our new website, naprecycling.com, where you can specifically search for items, and it tells you where it goes and why.
And is it working? I mean, are people adopting? Is this because you do these public education campaigns, yeah, and the results are, in the actual collections and what's winding up where, right?
Yes and no. So it is working in the sense that I think our customers are becoming more aware from reading the news and then also for, finding out information from us or coming to us and asking
questions.
That not all
plastic, for example, is going to get recycled.
Now, as I say no, because so our recycling contamination rates, which is right, the amount of stuff that's put in the recycling that we don't tell people to. Either they do it by accident or they don't care, usually by accident, or they're trying to do the right thing, or but they're confused.
Or it's this concept that you and I were talking about before the show, wish cycling,
right,
which is a term I'd never heard. What is wish cycling?
Yeah, wish cycling is, someone puts something in the recycling that they kind of know isn't supposed to go in there, but they're wishing that it can get recycled. And this is a lot of plastic packaging in particular. So, plastic bags still exist, even though you don't get them at the grocery store. But there's also kind of all kinds of packaging. It's food packaging. It's stuff from your online shipments, right? It comes with a bag of air now instead of styrofoam peanuts, so that air pillow.
And those don't go in recycling.
No, right. These are all things we can't recycle. They tangle in our machinery, and then they have no market, so they're a double whammy.
Wow.
Amazon ships with this white and blue envelope.
Yes.
You've seen it. We see it all
Got
the
one
time.
Yesterday, as a matter of fact.
That's not recyclable in our blue containers either. And so,
but this a is, lot of them wind up because people are kind of hoping that.
They also have a little weird, confusing thing on them that says recycle at a store drop-off, right? Because some stores have these drop-off bins for for plastic film, and you could put it there, but you have to take the label off. And a lot of stores don't have them anymore. This is really, right.
It
gets
it
to be
hard.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
We're at 6 times as much plastic film in our recycling as there was 10 or 15 years ago. And you realize that's actually society. I mean, people have always put things in the recycling, some of which were not the right thing. But there's just so much more plastic packaging, and it's really driven by online shipping, a lot of it, and just convenience. And I don't know if that problem is going to get solved just by people sorting correctly, because materials change all the time. I mean, companies figure out what is going to be better for their business. And we used to have a lot of newsprint, and that's going away. And now we have twice as much cardboard in our recycling stream.
Right, because thanks to Amazon boxes.
Yeah,
and
unfortunately, the cardboard's very recyclable, but inside of that box, there's also a lot of plastic packaging that we can't recycle, and so that would need to be taken out and put in the garbage, right?
Because most of us, you're opening that box, let's say the components of that box are all wrapped in plastic, or they've got padding or those air pockets or little wire twisties or whatever,
right.
And we use that box as the garbage container and then put it all into recycling.
Yeah, and so then on a sorting line, that shows up, and we have to kind of, our sorters either have to just take that whole thing and put it in the garbage because they don't have time to to pull it out, yeah. Or they think it's just a cardboard box and they put it with the cardboard, and then we have shipped cardboard that has plastic contamination with it. And if you hit over a certain percentage, the buyers of our cardboard are like, hey, you sent us contaminated cardboard.
Then there's economic penalties for you.
They'll ding it, or they'll say they won't take it anymore. Yeah. I mean, if you're really bad.
So last summer in Napa, the largest redemption center, Replanet, closed. That's the place where you can return bottles for the CRV or the deposit. Do you think that's a sign of things to come? And what effects did you see from that?
Yeah, so the little bit of the quick economic story about the bottle bill, right, is that a lot of these centers have closed in California, unfortunately, like 40% of them or something. And it's because the price of scrap aluminum has dropped 40% in the last year or last 2 years. And if you think about it, you're taking your you pay your 5 cents at the store, and then you get your 5 cents back when you bring it to the buyback center, and that's supposed to stimulate recycling. And if you do it. And if you don't and you put it in your blue recycling container, that money kind of goes to the state and then comes back to our recycling program, right, through payments from the state.
But you also see people harvesting.
Well, right, and they're getting the 5 cents that you paid.
Right.
But the buyback center doesn't make any of that 5 cents. It's just a pass-through. They are only making money off of scrap. And so you figure if it went down 40%, but their labor costs are going up and their rent's going up and they have equipment, they have balers and stuff.
Old Coke cans, basically.
Yeah. I mean, they're trying to fund that off of like the price of aluminum. And if the price of aluminum drops by half, they can't stay open. And so we have a buyback center that we operate at the Devlin Road Transfer Station that's still open, but you have to drive down, 9 miles south of town. We've seen a huge increase in business.
After that facility closed. Yeah. Are you the only one left?
There's a small one on Solano Avenue, Blue Front. It's at the small little market there. And they have been overwhelmed at times, too, because they weren't really set up to be the only center in Napa. We actually looked into trying to open at the Jackson Street location, but it doesn't seem like it's going to be able to go through. I think there's going to be another tenant that pays more.
Well, that's... that is kind of a universal tale in the Napa Valley
right
now.
Exactly.
So your company, I read, recycles about 14,000 tons of glass a year, half of which comes from the wine industry. I mean, no surprise there, given where we are.
Yeah.
How do the economics of those glass bottle recycling, that glass bottle recycling work?
Glass economics are actually pretty stable, which is actually nice. We have, we're fortunate, right? We have glass manufacturing in California. We make glass bottles, and we have the largest glass recycler in the country located in Fairfield Strategic Materials, which is where we send all of our glass. So when you see other communities in the country cutting glass out of their programs, it's because glass is very heavy to transport, and it's fairly low value, and that's just what it becomes. It's not that you can't recycle it and nobody wants to recycle it. It's just the cost of transporting
it. It's pretty easily recycled.
It's very easily. It can get recycled over and over again. It's a simple material as opposed to plastic.
Right.
So we've actually invested in some infrastructure or facility to clean the glass that we get out of the recycling to get all the other little things that are... So we're good with glass, and... one of the nice things is we do get a lot of high-quality glass from the wine industry that helps. It's worth more. It goes right back into making bottles. So the good bottle glass that's not all mixed color and all smashed up and mixed with other contaminants goes right back to making bottles. 35% of – there's a state law that says every glass bottle made in California has to have 35% recycled content, and that helps to drive the
– But it has to be recycled. It's not like you can clean them and use them again, right?
We've tried. We've worked on trying to collect bottles and send them back for reuse. Currently, it's hard to make that work, and mostly because there's so many shapes and sizes. And we would love if there was a little bit more there is a little bit fewer shapes and sizes, and they went to these uniform ones, and then you could kind of work with you could just use 6 or 8 shapes, which is what they do in Europe. But if you try to wash and reuse wine bottles now, you'd literally have to collect from X winery and send them the same bottles back because Y winery uses a different bottle.
Well, that's true, right? And that's marketing and
yeah, brand and so that's a thing that you kind of wrestle with. So it's hard to reuse them right now.
So about a year ago, there was a state legislator who wanted to revise the state's recycling program to put more of the responsibility on industry and keep basically the state from running this program or doing as much work. But it was opposed by a lot of people in the wine industry. What can you tell us about that approach, and why do you think it faced such opposition?
Yeah, so right now our bottle bill, right, the CRV program, is run through the state. The state collects the money and pays it out. We have some other programs that are EPR, Extended Producer Responsibility. That means the producer is in charge of running the recycling program. So the programs that we have for that in California are paint, mattresses, carpet, and
so those are kind of industry.
Yeah. So
support.
The difference is you pay a fee, a recycling fee on the front end when you buy a mattress or you buy a gallon of paint.
You put down a deposit, basically,
and that money goes. You don't get that money
back.
No,
that's right. That's right.
But you, it's not a deposit, but it helps to pay
for it to be
recycled.
It helps
to pay for the recycling program.
Got it. That's right.
And so, but that money doesn't go to the state. That money goes to a trade group. So Paint Care is the paint industry's trade group that they run as the paint industry. And what they do is that they use that money, and that funds drop-off points in different cities where you can drop off your paint for free. And so that is the type of program. It's called Extended Producer Responsibility. There's a talk of trying to make a program like that for beverage containers to take the state out of the game.
Including wine.
Yeah, and the wine is tricky, right, because you have so many different wineries. And the old model with beer and soda, though beer is changing. Beer has become a lot more like wine.
Fractionalized, yeah.
Where they would have to be becoming recycling centers. You know, there's an interesting debate in the recycling industry about how much this would take away from our business, right, if they decided to cut us out. I think there's good arguments both ways. I think one of the things that we do need is we definitely need more support for some of these lower value materials. This is one idea. Some of them are just charging fees. There's a ballot initiative that's getting signatures right now. Recology, the big garbage company in San Francisco, is actually funding with $6 million. And this is an initiative they're trying to get on the ballot in November. You talked about voting.
Yes.
This might be something you're voting on besides president in November.
If it gets on the ballot.
And it's a plastics, single-use plastics initiative. And so what it would do would be say, you got to have, if you're selling a material in California, it needs to be recyclable, reusable, or compostable. And there's going to be fees associated with it, too. So you might see that coming up.
So last question, since we are, as usual, the time goes by very quickly on this show. What's the best resource for people to go to keep up on the state of recycling in their communities and what they should and should not be doing with what they're disposing of?
Yeah, recycling is still very localized, right? Every city has its own program. So we drive people right to our website, naprecycling.com. You know, the thing we're saying is, when in doubt, find out.
Yes.
And if you can't find out, then sign up for a newsletter, send us an email, call us, send us a message on Facebook. We're happy to answer your questions.
That's great. Tim, thank you so much for joining us on the Deep Dive.
You're welcome. Thanks.
So that is going to do it for today's program. I want to thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive. As I said, we're happy to hear from you and especially welcome your suggestions on future discussions and guests. Please email us at deepdiveshow@winedownmedia.com, Twitter and Instagram at Deep Dive Show, and like us on Facebook at Deep Dive Show. I appreciate all the help I get from my friends here at KVON in Napa and from Antonio DeWalk. I appreciate that you joined us today, and we'll see you next time on the Deep Dive. I'm Larry Kamer.